Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC. ESG is about more than ticking boxes. It's about making your climate actions count. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Hello, you're welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock programme. I'm Joe Lynham, filling in for Mandy Johnston this week. Coming up on today's show, why quiet quitting is the phenomenon that just won't quit. And does any government really want to own shares in a bank? Plus, what makes Donald Trump so immune? You can email us, takingstock@newstalk.com. But let's start today with the issue of AIB and also a possible new rival in the form of Revolut. Turning to the banking sector first, with the government recently selling a 5% stake in the AIB group, raising 600 million euro, as well as Revolut's announcement that it would be entering the Irish mortgage market next year, changes are on the horizon for the banking sector. To discuss it, we're joined by Sean Keyes, the finance correspondent for The Currency. Sean, you're very welcome.
Hi, Joe.
Now, the government this week dispatched a further 5% of its shares in AIB. And let's remind everybody that, of course, at one point it owned 99% of AIB back in 2010 when the bank was bust and needed to be bailed out by taxpayers. So now the share ownership is down to 25.5%. It'll take a little bit longer, though, won't it, Sean, to get it down to zero?
It will. As you said, they started off at 99%. For about 10 years, nothing much happened. They wanted to sell the shares, but they couldn't sell the shares because the market for bank shares was very bad. The minister didn't want to be selling shares at a loss. It didn't reflect well on the government, so they hung on. But then everything turned in the last, say, 2 years, and the market for bank shares has suddenly got very hot indeed. And since 2022, the government has gone from 70% all the way down to 25% in a bit over a year and a half. And now, so, yes, now we're at 25%. They're selling about as fast as they can get them off the books. So that's roughly at the rate of 15% per year. So we're looking at maybe it would be at the current rate, it would be in the summer of 2025. They would get down to zero.
And what changes when the government gets out completely? What changes for the bank?
Well, one thing that would change, I suppose, is that if they would be free to pay their people more. That's an important one. They are limited in how they can pay their top executives at the moment, and that's a consequence of the government's share holdings in the bank. The bank doesn't like it. The bank's investors actually don't like it, despite the fact that the investors are the ones, you know, out of whose pocket the salaries are being paid. The reason that the banks care about that sort of thing is because, banks are very big, right? A bank like AIB owns more than 100 billion worth of things, 130 billion worth of assets, something like that. And so the decisions made by the chief executive and the team are very consequential. The difference between the very best possible decision and the second best possible decision might shake out to, you know, tens or even hundreds of millions worth of value, or even greater than that, into the billions. So yeah, that's why shareholders aren't too fussed on limiting the pay of what they can pay their senior people. And then I guess the other change you might expect is, like, if you look at AIB and compare it to Bank of Ireland, so the government's always had a bigger stake in AIB than Bank of Ireland. Both banks are quite similar. Both banks have needed to cut costs in the last 10 years, but Bank of Ireland is the one that's been able to do it much more aggressively. And when AIB has tried to make more aggressive moves in that direction, like in 2022, it announced it was going cashless in a number of branches. There was a huge fuss. It had TDs coming for an impromptu meetings in its front office, and it had to do a U-turn on it. And the end result is that the AIB has been much less aggressive cost cutting. So I think it might be reasonable to expect that once the government is fully divested, that AIB might act a bit more like Bank of Ireland, cut costs more aggressively.
I just wonder whether this salary thing is just all politically hyped. In other words, everyone hates the idea of earning more than them, but the vast majority of these bankers do earn more than the average salary. The cap is €500,000. It means that AIB won't be able to attract very, very senior people from all over Europe and all over the world to do those jobs. And I just wonder whether that's slightly hyped for political reasons, because the government still has a kind of a small world mentality about that.
Well, yeah, it's just a difficult thing to stand over, isn't it? And it's like, you know, I've been on radio and television before defending these fat cat bankers and their God given right to be paid over €1 million each, and how it's vital for the economy and everything. And like, you know, I think you can make a good logical argument for why it's true. That whole thing about, you know, the bank is so valuable, the decisions are consequential, it actually makes sense for the bank's perspective, from the shareholders' perspective and all that. But like, it's not very intuitive. And I think a lot of people just think, oh God, banks, all that they've cost the state, all that they've done in tracker mortgages, interest rates are going up. They're just not a very popular institution. And I mean, even like, you know, even if it were, you know, Metrolink is getting in a new CEO and he's going to be paid very well. And no one has any problems, particularly with a rail person, with the rail industry. But the thoughts of someone being paid a lot of money is kind of sticks in people's craw. And it's even worse when it's a banker, because bankers have all this baggage.
Yeah. I just wonder now if in the next couple of months, whether big international finance houses might look at taking a share in AIB and Bank of Ireland as well, for that matter, because they look undervalued. Given the strength of the Irish economy, given that, you know, the deposits they have and the housing stock that they are sitting on in terms of, you know, mortgage liens, whether the big crowds, whether that's BNP Paribas or Deutsche Bank or a British bank, might kind of pop in and say, you know what, I might want to own a quarter of this bank.
That's a very interesting question. I mean, the Irish banks, they are, in terms of their valuation, like, I think AIB is something like 0.8% of book value. And so that will put it at, it has a higher valuation than the rest of the European banking industry broadly, but a lower valuation than the American banks. American banks are the sort of the healthiest ones. But if you think it, like 0.8 of book value, like what the market is saying there is that actually, if you were to strip AIB down and sell it for parts, and just like, if it were somehow possible to just like slog off all of its loan book to, you know, whatever shadow banks or, you know, various funds and things like that, that AIB would actually be worth more than it currently, as it's currently constituted. So yeah, that sort of says something, right? That, like, a healthy bank should be worth more than some of its parts, and that's what you find in the U.S. In Europe, you don't find it that way. European banks are very, 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 very cheaply. Another thing you might say about it as well is that the Irish banks, they are, unlike the ones I've been talking about in both America and Europe, they are super heavily dependent on mortgages and money lending. So like almost all of their profits come from money lending in one form or another. And so that means that they're really tightly tied into the interest rate cycles. So like right now, interest rates are still high. So it's a good time for banks in general, and it's a very good time for Irish banks, because they make so much money. They're so dependent on this money lending stuff. But what it does mean as well is like that it kind of cuts the other way. And if their interest rates were to fall again, all of a sudden Irish banks would be a lot less profitable, and they're just much more volatile, let's say, than their peers. But so that they'd be the kind of things that an investor might be thinking about when they're just weighing up whether or not to invest in an Irish bank.
Do you think AIB, Bank of Ireland, PTSB are worried that Revolut, the internet bank based in London, could come in and offer mortgages and steal a bit of their business?
I would say they're exceptionally worried. I was looking at Revolut there this week, and like the interesting thing about them is if you go back to that valuation question. So as I said, like if AIB is valued at 0.8 a book, right? Revolut is valued at 20 times book. And so if Revolut, you know, it's currently not very profitable, but it's valued as though it's going to be very profitable in future. And so what that's saying is like, now, sorry, I should caveat this. This, you know, Revolut's still a privately traded bank. This valuation is kind of not very firm, but it's kind of roughly 20 times book. Anyway, what that valuation is saying is that investors think that Revolut is going to be much more profitable in the coming years. And if you look at the way Revolut works, it's been exceptionally successful in one way, which is that it's been exceptionally successful at attracting people onto its app, getting people to download it, set up an account, you know, send money to each other using Revolut. Revolut is a verb in Ireland now. Ireland, I think, is one of Revolut's top markets in the world on a per capita basis. It's got like 2.7 million users here. So it's done brilliantly at all that sort of stuff. But the way you really make money as a bank is back to that money lending thing. It's on loans. Like, loans are where the money's at when it comes to banking. And Revolut hasn't been able to do that up to now. It has a lot of users, but it hasn't managed to attract a lot of money from those users. So it's people have the phone or the app on their phone, but they don't have their savings on the app. They don't have their salary in the app. And so as long as Revolut doesn't have people depositing money into it, it'll struggle to really make money from lending, because that's obviously that's where the money comes from to actually do the lending. So yeah, that's the dynamic at play. At the moment, it's got loads of users. It hasn't got a lot of deposits, but the market and the investors think it probably will manage to make that leap in future and get into the really lucrative business of lending.
You're listening to Newstalk's Taking Stock with me, Joe Lynham. We're talking to Sean Keyes, the finance correspondent for The Currency website. Staying with Revolut, Sean, Revolut is not exactly associated with its customer-friendly attitude. It doesn't have a whole bunch of people answering phones. It doesn't answer the phone at all. And then there are, of course, security issues with cybercrime and getting your money back if you have been defrauded. Surely that is going to be a problem for the Central Bank of Ireland when these guys come to offer mortgages next year.
Well, this is the other issue with Revolut. Is the first issue I alluded to is getting people to trust it with their savings, and the other issue is getting regulators to trust it. So it operates now. It's got a license in, I think it's Lithuania, and it uses that kind of EU passporting rules to operate around the EU on the basis of that license. But it's been applying for licenses in the UK and in Ireland, and the process has been incredibly low in both jurisdictions. I think particularly Ireland, the central bank in Ireland has really taken its time over approving Revolut, its full banking license. That's going to slow Revolut down, but it'll still, like, ultimately still entitled to operate here. It's still entitled to lend money here, and I think what the license will eventually do, if they get it, will be to kind of help with that whole thing of engendering trust, help Revolut say to Irish customers, you can trust us, we are legit, you can put your salary, you can put all your savings into your Revolut app.
Yeah, that will take time. And the Central Bank of Ireland, of course, is still in many ways fighting the war from 14 years ago after the collapse in confidence in the banking sector, whether it would give out a permission to sell mortgages here, the biggest single investment, to a bank which is ephemeral, to put it one way, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's the culture of the Central Bank of Ireland is, I think, very very much focused on the downside risk of a banking blow up, and we all understand why that is.
Sean, thank you very much for joining us. That's Sean Keyes, finance correspondent for the Currency website. Up next, why quiet quitting isn't quitting, and it isn't just millennials. Yeah, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. This is Joe Lynham sitting in for Mandy Johnston this week. Yeah, quiet quitting is a phrase born out of lockdown where employees discovered that they could have a work-life balance. As the return to offices ramps up, the newfound gains were not going to be lost as employees decided to put life before work. Is this good? And how can employers begin to understand the newfound needs of their employees? I'm delighted to be joined by Sinead English, the founder and CEO of Hilt, a leading provider of career growth advisory services for individuals and organizations. Hey, Sinead.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
What is quiet quitting?
Quiet quitting. It's a catchy phrase, isn't it? It started about 2 years ago on TikTok, of course, and it suffers a little bit from misleading name syndrome because it's not about quitting. It's not about, you know, sneaking quietly out the door and never coming back and waiting for somebody to notice. But it describes a situation or a trend whereby you come to work, you do exactly what you're supposed to do in your job description. You do it very well. It's not a work to rule type thing where you're doing the bare minimum, but you don't consistently go above and beyond. You know, you don't stay late. You don't build that into your working week. You get your work done in the allotted time. But when it's time to go home, you go home. And basically, you're thinking that you're working to live rather than living to work. You value, you practice work-life balance. And you feel your work,
it sounds
work
time. It sounds a bit like a work to rule as currently enjoyed by Aer Lingus pilots.
Well, indeed, but it's not a work to rule because let's think about it. Is setting a healthy boundaries at work and not every day feeling that you have to fit 130% work into 100% of your time? It's not going to work. So is setting healthy boundaries a sign of a work to rule? Or is that a sign of disengagement and a bad work ethic? And I think that's the nub of the issue here, in that some organizations feel that built into somebody's career progression should be this feeling that work comes before everything and that you should be prepared to sacrifice everything in order to climb the ladder and to be progressed throughout the organization.
This sounds to me like the kind of thing that would only be possible in an era of full employment. It definitely wouldn't have been possible when I came out of university when unemployment was in the mid-teens.
Yes, exactly. And probably at that stage, it was very much get in, get a job, get your head down and work hard. And yeah, things like work-life balance were aspirational. Nobody even thought about that. If you said to somebody, I'm concerned about my work-life balance, well, you know, that was probably a sign that it was time for you to leave that organization. But now your work-life balance is the second most important factor to people when they're looking for a job. So it is
cash number one?
No, job security is number one. Financial compensation is number three.
Gosh.
And this is a survey that's done every 2 years. It's over 100,000 respondents globally. Boston Consulting Group do it. And what's interesting actually is that job security this year has jumped to number one, and 2 years ago it was number seven. So even though there is full employment, there is still quite a lot of concern over mass redundancies, you know, and companies just deciding they're closing down divisions. We see it a lot over the last 2 years or so. But work-life balance is number two. And it has been consistently over the last 6 years in the top three.
You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Joe Lynham. We're talking to Sinead English, the founder and CEO of Hilt, which advises companies. And we're also talking about quiet quitting. Now, can I assume that this obsession with work-life balance is mostly for younger people who are relatively new to the workplace?
I think it is has been driven to a large extent by the younger people, the Gen Z as we call them, in that they're coming into the workplace and realizing that their health and well-being is more important to them than climbing a career ladder. And they feel that they should be allowed to do both, and they should be allowed to maintain their health and well-being and also be successful at work. And I think that is a mind shift, a mindset shift for people who maybe are of an older generation and it wasn't like that when they were starting work and building up their career. And you know, we have seen some organizations that we work with will tell us now that the questions the candidates are asking in interviews are very different than the questions they were asking many, many years ago. For example, companies are telling us that candidates are saying, you know, what is your policy on work-life balance? What is your policy on the environment? Why should I work for you? These are questions that candidates are asking the interviewers. So yes, they are
unimaginable 20 years ago.
Absolutely. You'd be kicked out the door, you know, troublemaker.
Is this a European thing, Sinead? I.e., it's clear that Europeans put great value on free time and their hobbies and doing stuff outside the workplace and switching off and not responding to emails when they're not working. I just can't imagine this in America, which values getting on, earning as much money as quickly as possible. I can't imagine quiet quitting being as prevalent.
Well, quiet quitting was the phenomenon, if you call it that, was started in America. But I think there's three different levels that I would see to quiet quitting. And I think there's a bit of confusion about what it actually is. So, for example, if you look at Forbes, you know, the magazine Forbes, they will say that quiet quitting is an indication that employees are chronically disengaged. That's how they describe quiet quitting. I would disagree. I don't think that's quiet quitting. Quiet quitting is realizing that you are working to live and you're not, you know, that you're basically living to work and not working to live. That you respect and value your free time and you're not going to become just a cog in a wheel in your organization. So there's three layers. The first is the chronically disengaged. You know, they're going to do the bare minimum. They have always been around. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon, but we can now call them the quiet quitters if we want to, because that's the new phrase. It's basically they're feeling, you know, work is getting in the way of my living. You know, I'm just doing it the bare minimum because I have to. And I am chronically disengaged. And we probably have all worked with people like that. But the next layer up is the people who put their life before work. They do their job well. They keep up with the changes. They always deliver what they're supposed to deliver. They're really good employees, but they have a different perspective on what's important in their life. And they're not going to become, you know, basically subsumed in the job, and their identity gets driven just by what they do in their work.
I presume this quiet quitting phenomenon happens in white collar work, in brain power led work. It can't really happen if you're physically making stuff.
Well, it could happen in the services industry as well. You may not be around for very long because, you know, that's a very, very high turnover role. But in the services industry, there would be a number of people who would just be doing the bare minimum. I'm sure we've all been in situations where you go into a shop.
You mean restaurants and hotels?
Yeah. Yeah, where people are just, you know, hardly looking at you when they're serving you, really couldn't care less, just don't want to be there. Mm. So that, you know, that you could call that quiet quitting.
Well, that's probably loud quitting.
exactly, yeah.
Has anyone ever worked out how much quiet quitting could cost an economy, if it costs the economy?
You know, there's been, again, it depends on how you're defining it. You know, if you're defining it as the chronically disengaged, which I don't think it should be defined that way, but some organizations and some, you know, media outlets will define it as that. I think, I mean, that could cost an organization, you know, I'm going to say 10 to 20% of their revenues every year. They could be earning an extra 10 to 20% of revenues every year by virtue of the fact that their employees are just doing the bare minimum, chronically disengaged, just dialing it in. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely has a financial cost. And, you know, and it comes back to then the question is, well, why are employees so disengaged at work? What can organizations do to engage those employees? There's probably going to be a sector of them that doesn't matter what you do, they'll be disengaged. But there is, you know, quite a large percentage of employees who feel, oh, you know what, I want to do more, I'd like to do more, but because of the culture in this organization or the management or the unrealistic expectations put on me. Some managers feel that this person is not performing as they should, but the manager's expectation is that they should be doing 130% more than, you know, that their work should be basically 1.5 times, the output should be 1.5 times they're actually capable of producing in a day, be that a knowledge worker or somebody working in the services industry. So, you're setting people up to fail, and then managers are going, oh, well, they're quiet quitting, or they're not doing what they should be doing, which is unfair.
Is there a risk, Sinead, that the demands become insatiable? In other words, that the demands put on employers, let's say they're met. Let's say they get extra time off. Let's say they don't have to answer their phone once they're away. Let's say they get nearly everything they want, but the employee still comes back and wants more and more. At what point does it stop and say, you know what, we literally can't do anymore?
Yeah, I mean, the business has to be profitable and it has to be commercial. And if the employees are making unrealistic demands of the organization based on the size of the organization, of course, the organization is going to push back and say, no, we can't do this. But I think fundamentally, though, if you look at the reasons why employees are disengaged and why they're just feeling, you know, I don't really feel part of this organization and why I want to move, it's more basic things. It's not, I want more time off, or I want more, yoga classes or things that make me feel good about myself. It's things like, as I mentioned, unrealistic expectations, lack of recognition for doing a good job, feeling that nobody really cares, nobody's really listening. I've been asking for a review, or I've been asking for somebody to sit down with me and talk about my career progression for 6 months and nobody really seems interested. They're the reasons why employees feel disengaged and maybe begin to switch off a little bit and then ultimately could leave the organization.
Do you think companies should allow their staff a side hustle, as in, or you know, having side jobs, earning kind of other sides, other bits of income elsewhere?
It depends on the organization. I mean, generally, I wouldn't see that there's an issue with it as long as it's not going to be competing with for your time that you're supposed to be spending in the organization, or you're not using proprietary information that you've gained in the organization to go and do a side hustle somewhere else. I mean, I would know a lot of people who have got a full-time, quote-unquote, job that are doing something else as well to make a little bit more income. And maybe it's like a hobby they have and they make a little bit of extra income on it. But as long as it's not interfering with your ability to do your job and to produce at 100% and to deliver what's expected of you. It's just, I feel that a lot of organizations, their expectations of their employees are set so high now that when you're just delivering what you're supposed to be delivering, that's not enough. And that's what makes people feel a bit demotivated.
What if the economic cycle changes? At the moment, the Irish economy is quite robust, but economies are always engaged in an economic cycle. Things will change. What if a recession were to arrive, unemployment were to spike? I suspect that the quiet quitting might quietly quit.
Well, the chronically disengaged will find themselves out of a job, that's for sure. So that lower tier. I think the middle tier, the people who put their life before work, will be okay, because we have to realize that whether it's, you know, in a downward spiraling economy or even in the, you know, boom times, people's mental health, people are going to leave a job or they will start to disengage from a job if they're not felt that they're being treated fairly in the organization. And while it might take them longer to leave, or maybe they're going to stay stuck in the job because they're feeling, okay, I'm better not, you know, raise my hand and say I'm unhappy because I'm going to lose my job, but they will start to underperform within the organization. Will they be, you know, if a company is losing business and it's not doing well in the economy, good people and underperforming people are going to lose their jobs. The underperformers will go first, I guess.
Sinead, thank you so much. That's Sinead English there, the founder and CEO of Hilt, H-I-L-T. Up next, how Donald Trump has had one hell of a good week. Yeah, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. This is Joe Lynam sitting in for Mandy Johnston this week.
This nation was founded on the principle that there are no kings in America. Each of us is equal before the law. No one is above the law. not even the President of the United States. But today's Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity, that fundamentally changed. For all practical purposes, today's decision almost certainly means that there are virtually no limits on what a president can do. This is a fundamentally new principle, and it's a dangerous precedent, because the power of the office will no longer be constrained by the law, even including the Supreme Court of the United States.
It has the potential to reshape America. In the short term, it may offer Donald Trump a get-out-of-jail-free card over his actions on January the 6th, 2021. I'm talking about the U.S. Supreme Court majority judgment this week that has said U.S. presidents have some immunity from criminal prosecution over some of their actions while in office. To explain what this may mean, I'm delighted to join Joe Miller, U.S. legal correspondent with the FT, and he's on the line. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Why has the Supreme Court thrown all the cards up in the air?
Well, Joe, a cynic would suggest that is because of the nine justices on the Supreme Court, six of them are conservative-leaning, and indeed three of them were appointed by Donald Trump while he was president, and therefore they decided to rule in his favor. But if we were to leave cynicism aside for a bit, it's because a majority, a 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court, decided for the first time in a landmark decision that a president of the United States has broad criminal immunity for official acts while in office. In other words, when the president is going about his duty as president, doing the things he needs to do to get the job done, the actions that he takes cannot then be used to prosecute him in a criminal prosecution once he leaves office. And this has never been established before, because it's never been asked before, because we've never had a former president subject to criminal prosecutions. But now we do, and now a majority on the Supreme Court have decided that broadly you can't prosecute a president for official acts while he was in office.
Now, we'll come to the ramifications in a moment, but I was looking back at old clips of some of these justices who voted to give the president some immunity. And in their Senate hearings, they all said no president is above the law. They've done a massive U-turn from what they told senators and congressmen and women.
Yes, you could argue that. I assume that they would say, if you were presenting them with those clips, that they haven't quite said that, that a president who does something illegal outside of their official duties while in office is still very much subject to criminal prosecution. And there is no defense that you were a sitting president at the time that you did that. But yes, it does seem to fly in the face of this sort of straight reading of those responses, or, you know, the way you and I would have taken them when they were said at the time. There's another criticism you could make of the justices, which is that the conservatives who ruled in the majority opinion here, they largely consider themselves to be what they call originalists, some people who stick to the very text of the Constitution. And nowhere in the Constitution does it actually say that a president is immune from criminal prosecution. They have, so to speak, read between the lines and come to this conclusion. So, you know, you could see a criticism from the right to say, hang on, you're not even sticking to your own principles. But there certainly doesn't seem to be any self-doubt in this opinion. If you read it, it's incredibly strident and incredibly clear that the majority set this precedent that a president now cannot be prosecuted for official acts while in office.
Now, we can't get our heads around this in Europe, in Britain or in Ireland or anywhere in Europe, that judges are given the job based on their political allegiances and where they stand on the political spectrum. But that is the case in the United States. There are six conservative or right-leaning judges on the Supreme Court and three left-leaning or liberal justices. What did the minority judges say? Because they can't have been too pleased.
The minority judges were fuming, to say the least. I've read many a dissent, as it's called, when the minority decides to write an opinion dissenting from the majority. And I don't think I've ever seen anything quite as scathing as the one that Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who's one of the liberals, wrote on behalf of The other liberals, you know, she said it would have disastrous consequences for our democracy. And she essentially posited this idea that this ruling means that the president could now use his official powers, his or her official powers, to assassinate a political rival or stage a military coup, or and would be completely immune. And she said that she fears for American democracy if this ruling were to stand. And it's, you know, probably the most forceful and most vociferous dissent I've ever read.
In theory, the law has now changed in America. In theory, Joe Biden could order the assassination of Donald Trump and get away with it if he thought it was in the interests of the country.
In theory, I think legal scholars who are now, you know, passing this, it's still being analysed, of course, because it's only just come out, and the contours of this decision are being pored over by scholars and analysts. But I think that most sane commentators would probably say that this ruling doesn't really say that you can assassinate a political rival, because you would have to argue that was an official act, that that was an act that the founders, the framers of the Constitution, wanted the president to have. And that's a little bit of a stretch. So perhaps it's a little bit hyperbolic to say that, you know, because of this decision, Joe Biden could now assassinate a rival. But I think the concern is that, you know, these decisions, these questions should be questions that are decided by Congress, whether a president is or isn't behaving themselves, and, you know, whether there should be a prosecution, etc., or, you know, whether they should be impeached. And now what you've got is the Supreme Court wrestling that power back to the judiciary and saying, if you want to prosecute a president for something they've done in office, you basically have to run it by us first, and we'll decide whether it's an official act or not. And what happens if you have a majority on the Supreme Court that decides, you know, something that you might find abhorrent, you know, an invasion of a foreign country on spurious purposes, for example? What if they decide that's an official act? Well, you know, now it's in their hands, so to speak, and some would argue that's not particularly democratic.
You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Joe Lynam. We're talking to Joe Miller, US legal correspondent with the FT.com. Joe, it's got to be one of the best weeks that Donald Trump has had since being booted out of the White House 4 years ago.
It really has. And, you know, for every time his legal strategy, which is essentially to delay and frustrate and to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks, every time that is vindicated, you think surely this is the end of the road for that particular tactic. And then another reprieve comes along, and this is the greatest of them all, because not only does it essentially push the so-called January the 6th case, which is about his alleged attempt to overturn the 2020 election, it pushes that until, or it pushes a trial in that case, I should say, until way after the November election, if it ever happens. So it's got rid of that case, but it also, and we can talk about this if you like, has repercussions for the other three criminal cases which he faces. And so essentially, as he is heading towards the election, leading in the polls, he's got rid of the vast majority of his legal problems in almost in one fell swoop.
Has American democracy changed?
People who are, you know, far more acute observers of the state of American democracy than me would say that, yes, it has, and it has forever. You know, you can look at it two ways. You can say, you know, a stake has been driven through the heart of American democracy here, where you have a president who essentially, you know, allegedly incited a riot and tried to overturn the election and didn't want to leave office. And he's more or less getting away scot-free. And you could say that that's a very bad idea for democracy. Or you could say, look, all the Supreme Court has done here is saying to the American people that if you want to get rid of this guy, go to the ballot box and vote against him. That, you know, we should not be using legal chicanery and, you know, other forms of so-called lawfare, as the you know, Trump camp like to call it, to get rid of someone we don't like. We have a democratic system that's set up to do that. And every American will be able to make that choice come November.
And it's not just on this particular instance that the Supreme Court has weighed in. It has overturned very long-standing precedent, notably Roe v. Wade and the right to an abortion federally.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, this is an interesting aspect to this conservative dominated Supreme Court, is that you could think of it as being a court that is consistently ruling in Donald Trump's favor, or at least in, you know, conservatives' favor. And it does that. But the extent to which that helps conservatives is still up in the air, in that, for example, Roe v. Wade, you know, that decision came down and it has galvanized Democrats around the country. It has helped Democrats win some very tight races because there's been a backlash, especially by younger women who are appalled by this decision, who are appalled at the idea of them, of their rights being taken away. And you can tell by the attack ads and by the campaign messaging from the Democrats, especially in what they call the down ticket races. So the, you know, the governorships and the Senate seats and the House seats, that this has become a key topic for the Democrats, and they think it might help them win. So while you do have a Supreme Court that's tilted in Donald Trump's favor, it isn't always favorable to Donald Trump.
They're going to struggle to get re-elected if they've got an 81-year-old who can't string a sentence together.
Yes, and I imagine we might get news on that in the next couple of days, one way or another. The wagons seem to be circling around Joe Biden and the demand that he at least prove that he is capable of stringing a sentence together. You know, those demands are getting louder and louder. But yes, if the polls are anything to go by, his disastrous debate performance the other week has done the Democrats no favor. And, you know, regardless of we're talking about Donald Trump's, you know, legal travails, etc., none of that would really matter if indeed, you know, his condition becomes appreciably worse. And, you know, people are worried about, I think rather reasonably, about having a president who's not necessarily compos mentis. And if the Democrats don't put up the best fight, I think we can, you know, declare this election over. But I think it looks like in the next couple of days, maybe some announcement one way or another.
From a legal point of view, would a contested Democratic convention in the summer, is there anything preventing the Democratic delegates booting Joe Biden off the ticket?
There is, and his name is Joe Biden, in that legally, in the US, unlike in other countries where, you know, in the UK, for example, you have the so-called men in white suits, and it usually is men in grey suits, and it usually is men in the Conservative Party who can come and depose a leader. In the US, it doesn't work like that. Now that Joe Biden has essentially got pledged delegates, he won the primaries hands down, the Democratic primaries, and he has pledged delegates all around the country, it's up to him to say to them, you are free to vote for someone else. So he would have to stand down first. He would have to make that decision. And then he could decide to say, okay, you know, vote with your conscience, vote for one of the six or seven contenders to take over and be the Democratic nominee. Or he could say, please vote for, say, Kamala Harris, my vice president, to take over. But it is entirely in his hands. There is no legal mechanism for doing it if he objects.
Will he stand down in the next week or so?
It's hard to tell, but I think the reporting from the New York Times in the last couple of days is probably the strongest signal we've had so far that he's at least considering it. They said that he's been talking to a couple of, you know, key allies, and he understands that he only has a week or so to convince the public that he is indeed, you know, up for the job and up for the task. And there's going to be a big interview on ABC, which is coming up, and that's going to be his first big set piece since the disastrous debate. And that, I think, will be the moment that either, you know, sinks or saves his candidacy. If he has another stumbling performance, I think the consensus is that it would then become, you know, ridiculous to keep running him, and then we would be in the arena of a contested convention.
Thanks, Joe. That is Joe Miller, the US legal correspondent with the FT.com. Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. I've been Joe Lynam, filling in for Mandy, who shall return next week. Thanks to producer John Fardy and researchers Simon Keane and Steve Daunt. I'll also remind you that this show is available as a podcast every Friday morning, and it's on the radio every Sunday from 9 a.m. Stay tuned for Anton and enjoy the rest of your weekend.